And I want to know who cut the cheese. I'll tell you this for openers. We are going to set off an area on the balcony. And God help whoever doesn't use it, because the next stink I have to smell in this office, and whoever doesn't admit to it, is going out the window, into the muck, under their fucking heads, and we'll see how they like farting from that position.
To all, and to all a warm welcome to the show where we take a nostalgic trip through an entire series, one season at a time. Consider them through a modern lens. I'm one of your hosts, Jack, alongside my international friend and co-host, Tony Farina. This is TV Admired when it first aired, and this is the podcast where we assess whether it stands the test of time. Elephant hunting season opens in Deadwood, a boom town full of promise and prospect, but also manipulation and murder. A lawless camp where every man, woman, and all manner else are a little bit broken, but subjective respective principles aren't. A place where we all have bloody thoughts. Season's greetings to the year of the elephant, cocksuckers.
Nice. Loved it. You limey bastard. Yeah. And the funny thing is, this is like the least English Ian McShane has ever been. And they are like that limey bastard the whole time. I'm like, what's it like when they say cut?
You sure?
You know what I mean? It's like, because he's not talking like himself at all. It's so funny. Well, welcome back to Season's Greetings, my friend.
No, yes, it's good to be back.
It's good to be back. And so apologies to everybody who was expecting the return, the triumphant return to be Star Trek. That will happen. We've got plans with Neil. We'll try to get Dan, you know, because we know what a big Trekkie he is. I'm finishing up Stranger Worlds right now. It is amazing. We've got stuff. But there's no reason with the return of Raylan an excuse to hang out with Timothy Oliphant. Come on. We'll make the connection. Did you see the story that J.J. Abrams had him try out to be Kirk?
I did read that. Yes, I did. Which was unbeknownst to me until clearly the story's...
Me too. Yeah. And it's funny. Yeah. He went in to read. He thought he was going to go in to read for Bones.
Which I could see that.
Actually. Which I actually think he would have been better. But instead, by the time he got there, he's already like, I got that guy. I don't need you for that.
I mean, and they did get that guy.
Carl, oh, my God.
Amazing.
His boss. Yeah. I mean, again, what a great actor. But we're not here to talk. Anyway, so Star Trek. I mean, listen, Oliphant. I mean, we can maybe, with the Oliphant season, I mean, we have to have the discussion of whether we revisit Mando or just have like a very special Mando episodes at the end, the Oliphant supercut. Whether I'm going to make you watch The Grinder. We'll see. I've not watched Santa Clara Diet.
No, me neither.
It's nothing like this, obviously. So these are the Westerns of Oliphant. That's what we're doing.
They are. So yeah, we're doing the three of Deadwood, and then I don't know if we've really definitely decided in what form, but we'll do the Deadwood movie as well.
100%. Yeah.
And then, yeah, we've got, what, seven seasons now because of...
The new season of Justified. Yep. Of Primeval.
So we are, we've got a year of Oliphant.
Which is, listen, and you know what? You know who's mad about that? Nobody.
Nobody. I mean, the first thing Emma said to me, my partner, when I announced that, well, we're going to shift Star Trek and we're going to do this. So how quickly is it we can watch Justified again? Okay, well, you get hold your horses.
I've got 3 months. Well, hold all your horses. Well, that's the thing too, is Lee loves Justified as well, and it's funny because she doesn't like super violency stuff. And in the new seasons of Justified, like, you know, there's some fisticuffs, as there are, and she doesn't love that because it's so graphic.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? It's just like it is in Justified. Yeah. Like when there's fistfights in Justified, they don't cut away.
No.
It's not a Christopher Nolan direction, a fist fight. It's it lingers. So anyway, yeah, but this is exciting. And so this is my second run through, but I did not watch it when it first aired because in 2004, I was going through a divorce and I had a 3-year-old, or 2004. So I would have had it. Yeah, I would have had a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old. So
you weren't showing them Deadwood?
I was not, and I couldn't afford HBO even if I was showing them Deadwood. Now, to be fair, when they were little, you know, they saw all kinds of shit. Like, I 100% remember when Emma was maybe 6 months old, just me and her sitting there watching Highlander.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. But this sound and height and That's what it is at that point.
Could you imagine that? I was 6 months old. You're like, and then.
Although actually, I remember getting told off by Em when she came down and I was watching Die Hard. I think it was Die Hard 4.0, the Timothy Olyphant one, ironically. Yeah, yeah. Or Live Free and Die Hard, whichever.
Live Free and Die Hard. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, depending on which territory you're in. But he was a baby and was trying to relax and sleep. And I had that on. She was like, well, why do you think he's not sleeping? There's bloody Die Hard on in the background. Yeah, good point, actually.
Yeah, because that's not a quiet movie. Yeah. No, Emma was wide awake and we were just watching Highland. It was on. I mean, look, if I'm flipping around and Highlander's on, I'm probably going to stop.
Sure, absolutely.
And it's bad.
Highlander 2, you're going to keep moving on.
I would. It's bad enough to watch. But anyway, we're not here to do that. Although, if we were to reboot Highlander, which I hear they're going to do, the John Wick guys, it would not be a mistake to have Timothy Olyphant.
No, I could see that. Yeah.
I mean, he's aged remarkably well, although he does have the gray hair now. So,
wearing it well, though.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, for sure. So I'm excited about this. So Deadwood, here's the interesting thing about Deadwood. And before we start talking about the show, and obviously that's my history with it, we'll get into some history of Deadwood itself. But what is your history with it? So I obviously didn't come to this when you did. So 2004, did you guys have HBO over there? How did you watch it?
No, so it was on Sky here, which we have HBO now, I suppose, kind of.
With Max, yeah.
Absolutely. And then, but really things just get bought out and farmed off to different channels. So this was on Sky, I believe, but I didn't watch it like that on TV. This was actually introduced to me through my dad.
Oh, nice.
You end with those Meal Rear, fellow podcaster, Femon. You know, we've got a bit of a fraught relationship with him and he's been in and out of our lives. But there was a period in my mid-20s when we were working fairly close to each other. So we would meet up every now and then for lunch. And it was here's a box set. I've watched this. I think you'll probably really get a lot out of this. And it was season one of Deadwood. So I'm obviously watching it, you know, at least into season two. In fact, I think probably it's coming towards off the air. I don't think I watched any of it live. It was all each time a box set came out, I was then buying and watching. So yeah, not far off it being on, but yeah, it wasn't a thing that was in my sphere of watching of knowledge because I didn't have the channels to watch it.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And I think, and this is where Allison and I were having this discussion, texting each other back and forth. And I sent her rambly messages about like art. And she writes back because she's a decent person. She doesn't like have me committed or anything. you know, because she makes films. You know, I mean, I say them to you because I see you and talk to you. And it's like, you know, she's a filmmaker and, you know, you guys get it. You guys love art in the way that I do. And it's, but it's frustrating because we lose, like stuff isn't tangible. And like I bought these box sets. And as I said, I was a little disappointed because the box, they were wrapped in plastic. So I thought they were brand new, but some shyster had wrapped them. And several of my discs in my first season box set didn't actually play. I played them in several different players and they didn't play. So that was sad, but it's fine. It's what it is. But like the idea of physical media, like your dad could do that where we're losing that ability to be like, here, try this, to be like, hand someone a book and be like, here's this. Like, we can't do that. And because you should be able to buy a digital book and then give it to somebody and be like, here, I'm sending you an email. Here's the book. And I understand the argument is, well, that's just a copy.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a way to...
That is a copy of a physical book.
Correct. But their argument is, like, I would, if I send you an email of the PDF, I still own the PDF. There's two now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
But there's got to be a way where you can actually, you know, put a code on there that it can only be on one device at a time. And there's a code, you know, like there's got to be a way, but they don't want to do it. So instead, you can't share digital media. You can share digital music, but you can't share digital books. You can't share digital movies. I, of course, found a way to share digital movies because I paid for a device where I can rip my DVDs and they're mine. So I can loan you a copy of my movie. I don't put it up on YouTube.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can give you a copy of something because I could do that with the CD. So that's how I feel. If I fucking buy the DVD, I should be able to let somebody have it. You know, and so it's amazing too, this idea of the way that art lives and doesn't live. And the article that I was reading last night said when Netflix first started and there was still the DVD rental, which is how I first came to
Netflix.
Yeah,
me too.
They had 100,000 titles.
Wow.
And right now, as of yesterday, because I was reading this in the New York Times yesterday, there are 6,600 titles on Netflix.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, what the fuck? And it's because they don't own, like with the DVDs, they could buy the DVDs and they could rent them out. But now they didn't want to buy the rights to all of that.
So
I do believe there's a place for either video stores. I still go to the library and get DVDs from the library all the time. But I do think there could be a place for somebody, whether it's Redbox or somebody, to come back into the marketplace and be like, hey, even if it's still just mail order again, I think people would be interested just because we're losing stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's becoming its own digital pandemic now, isn't it? You know, people getting rid of their own titles, which is, the Netflix thing I get, like, you know, the rights, I understand they pay for them for a certain amount of time and enough people aren't watching it, so they decide they don't want to.
Right, because they're borrowing a movie that somebody else made.
I get that. But, like,
but
know,
when it's their own thing,
I know, like getting rid of the princess and getting rid of Rosaline and all these other, I don't understand. Like, it's yours, it just sits there. What's the problem?
Yeah. That, I mean, you can, and at least with the princess, you know, you can get that on, I know I watched it on DVD.
Okay.
So I know how I watched it. But it's so weird. Things are weird and it's all just makes me sad. But this still lives on HBO Max. Like when you go to HBO Max, this is still one of the things they show. Like this and Veep, they're like, and Game of Thrones, they're like, these are the three things we're most proud of, obviously. These will always be, and they're the most vile. Now, I've never watched Game of Thrones, to be fair. But like what I know of it and this, and definitely Veep, the things where you have the most swearing are the things they're never going to get rid of. Anyway, so that's just us talking about art, and we'll get into this. But so the history of Deadwood is interesting because it's a real place. These are real people for the most part.
For the most part. Yeah.
There are some fictional people here. I see you're reading a book. I'm going to pick
not
up a
yet,
book. I don't know how to... I didn't know
I'm
how
wait
to...
till we've re...
Oh, okay.
Then I'm going to read it, yeah.
Yeah, I know... You sent me the recommendation. I'm trying to figure out how to send you a recommendation back on Goodreads. But there's also a work of work. It's a historical fiction that won I think the Pulitzer or National Book Award about Charlie and Wild Bill. I guess what it's called. Deadwood. Go figure. So I'm going to read that and see if that's worth reading. Probably is. But yeah, a lot of these people are real. A lot of them are fictional versions of themselves. A lot of them are amalgamations. I don't have the full list of who's real and who's not. I don't know if you've done that research.
Well, it's available, but I would say don't look it up yet because you haven't finished watching all the way through to the end of season three. So I would say save that because there are some potential, well, it's not a spoiler, but you know, there's some things that'll be nice to have revealed to you as it happens.
Sure. But I mean, we know that Wild Bill Hickok, Charlie Utter, Calamity Jane, Al Swearengen, Seth Bullock, Saul Starr, these are real people.
Yeah.
Everybody else can be whatever they are. The funny thing is, as I was thinking, we're going to spend a year on Oliphant. And obviously, you would say the person you and I have talked about the most in the history of the world is Sarah Michelle Gellar and or David Boreanaz. However, if you were to look at our Pop Gorillas content, it's actually Chucky.
Okay, yeah.
Because he's Doc in this.
Yeah.
What's his name? Brad. What's his name? I don't know how to say his last name, probably. Brad Dourif.
Yeah.
He plays Chucky. It's ridiculous. All those fucking Child's Play movies too. So Brad Dourif is going to get a lot of love.
He's definitely going to get a lot of love. He's amazing.
He's amazing in this for sure. But anyway, so like those are some real people, and then there's obviously some amalgamations and like.
So Doc is an amalgamation, and Trixie's an amalgamation as well.
Right, and Jewel, like just like you take some characters that you know could have existed, and you make them. But other people are real, and Alma Garrett's real, right? Or not?
No, I think she's an invented character.
Was she invented? Okay.
Yeah, and
so Ellsworth, the women. Screw the women, except for Jane.
Yeah, Ellsworth is invented as well, I think.
Okay.
But of our core characters, pretty much all of them are real people that were in the town. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting way to do it. And of course, it's fun to set a historical Western where you use some real people, because like the American Western is kind of that, like the best Westerns are the ones that are like, you take people that you know and you mythologize them. Because there is this mythology of the American West told through the Western. And then there was, of course, the spaghetti Western, which was the Italian version of America, which I always find fascinating. So before we get into this, and I know you love this, and I know I'm dragging my heels, but I just want to ask you this big question. What is your feeling of Westerns in general before this and post this? Like, and has this, like, has watching this, when you watch this as a younger person and then you rewatch it all the time, has it changed your opinion on what a Western could be and or should be?
Yes, I think so. This, and then a probably quite soon afterwards discovery of Cormac McCarthy and Blood Meridian.
Whew.
Absolutely sort of revolutionized in my head, like, oh shit, okay, this is what it could be. And I think we do get more things which push that side of that envelope now, don't they? In my younger days, I can't say Westerns were anything that I was particularly bothered about. I'd seen the big Westerns because they were things that were spoken about that I wanted to watch. You know, I'd seen Unforgiven and, you know, the other end of the scale, I'd seen Young Guns and Young Guns 2, you know, as a younger person, obviously. So there were things I'd watch, but not things I would actively go out my way, I don't think, to watch. Post-Edward, perhaps as a more mature person, I don't know. This idea of looking into the past to reveal the future. I think Westerns do what sci-fi does, right? It tells you about right now, but by looking at how things were back then, whereas sci-fi looks at the future and tells you things about right now. So I think we have that really nice meeting point here. And Deadwood is definitely doing that. It's definitely Milch's chance to talk about some things he really wants to talk about by looking back, by using some real people, by looking at their motivations and how they operate together. I think, yeah, it definitely changed how I viewed Westerns completely.
I love that. I love you saying that way. And like, to me, I think that's an excellent point, because my problem with Westerns sometimes is that Westerns fall into the trap that fantasy falls into. And I think a Western like this, there's definitely violence and there's all kinds of things. And it's a bad, awful place. And there's murder and murder and more murder. But you know what this show doesn't do? While it's lingering and there's definitely lots of nudity and lots of sex and there's, you know, people who are clearly misogynist pricks and do all that stuff, this book doesn't focus on those old spaghetti. Like the Clint Eastwood spaghetti Westerns, there's always an assault of a woman.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, always. Yeah. Always. Even some of the Clint Eastwood, you know, the Clint Eastwood as a star, even some of the ones he's written and directed himself. And that is the cheap, easy way to add peril to women, to people in a Western, is, and fantasy, not Tolkien fantasy, not, you know, C.S. Lewis fantasy. Because if there was suddenly a sexual assault in Narnia, that is a different, that's never going to happen. Not those fantasies, not the fantasy that I like, but like that, like the, I never was interested in reading Game of Thrones. I knew what it was going to be. I knew it was going to be that. And I don't like that. I don't think using that as a plot point, as a, it's an extra, it's not a full fridge, but it's like almost a fridge. It's that. And I don't like it. And what I found fascinating with this is that isn't happening. It's a concern. Know that it's happening, but it's not a, like, because of course it is, because it is, because it's this kind of town with these kind of men and the way that women are treated. We understand. I mean, these women are sold, like we learn that they're sold. They are all the prostitutes in this, save for like two, that they are literal property. So that is obviously an assault. I'm not saying that it isn't, but it's not a, you know, a la Josie Wales or the Good, the Bad and the Ugly drag you into the stable by your hair kind of stuff. And I think that's what makes this, like, good Westerns more like science fiction, like you say, as opposed to just being exploitative for the sake of whatever. Like, I think, because it's more like a paint by numbers. This is what a Western has to have. This is how we prove they're outlaws. Well, if you shoot a 5-year-old, you're bad.
Sure.
Right? That's horrific enough. So we have that here, like episode 2. A family is murdered. Okay. We get what's going on. We don't need you to linger on it either. They don't linger with the way that the children are treated or any of those things, you know? So it's like, we know it's happening. We know it's out there. So anyway, so all of that to say, I think, and there is a high fantasy book series that I'm reading. I'm reading one of the new ones now. It's high fantasy science fiction. It's the Red Rising series by Pierce Brown. I don't know if you've read those, but there is, it's bad for everybody. You know, it's like a bad, awful, it's a, the world is at war and there's a lot of blood and there's a lot of guts, but it's a book. And I think in a book, it's different too. Like if they filmed these, there'd be stuff that they couldn't show.
Yeah. I think that's really fascinating because there is the, there's the potential for this show to do that.
There is.
Trixie is assaulted physically, not sexually, but physically.
Right, physically assaulted early on. Yeah.
Ow. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But it's important for her arc for her to start right at the bottom.
Correct.
And it's important for Ow to start as the worst kind of despicable person you could imagine for where he's going to go as well. So I think whether by design this early on, I don't know, but certainly by episode 12, that moment is really powerful and really important because of who those two people become across the course of the series.
Yeah.
And I know there's, I know there was at the time, and I don't know like retrospectively whether there is something we'll discuss in our research and more as we go. But I know at the time there were criticisms for the female characters. I find that really surprising. I think there's a core of female characters in this that have strength in a way that the male characters never could have. And we'll get into this more in our 2023 lens.
Of course.
Like, you know, Trixie, Alma, Jane, Jewel, all these characters have an inner strength.
Even Sophia.
Yeah, sure, Sophia, yeah. Actually, yeah, the little girl, yeah. So, and I think there's actually a celebration of female power and how they navigate the world in this show that is relevant probably still now and was relevant when it came out and was definitely relevant to where the setting was. So I find those criticisms really interesting. I find them personally, as a white middle-aged man, I find them unfounded. I think the show takes great pains to try and show that, yes, it was a heavy patriarchal time and women were treated despicably, but they found ways to navigate that word. I can't think of a better word at the moment than that.
Because navigation is the right word. And again, you know, we don't want to jump to the 2023 lens, and but I think you're right. I just kind of wanted to set the tone for how we feel about Westerns. Because now you're talking about a Western. Like most Westerns, Lee's not going to watch. Because, you know, it's just like, meh. And like we did go see, but we went and saw the remake, Fuqua's Magnificent Seven.
Sure, yeah.
And she was like, okay. That was, you know, that was ridiculous good fun too. It knew what it was. I mean, she looked at that cast and she's like, well, fucking Ethan Hawke and Vincent D'Onofrio and Chris Pratt and obviously Denzel. She's like, that's going to be fine. I'm going to be okay. Like there's going to be some whatever, but I'm going to be fine seeing that. And it was, and you know, that was for the most part, one of the best remakes of a remake of a remake. I mean, what is that? Like the, whatever that is, the seventh version of them. And this is, once we get to the seventh Magnificent Seven, the world collapses in on itself. So luckily that's not the seventh one. But like that was, you know, that was, so, you know, you pick and choose with Justified, the modern day Western, which obviously we did, it's, again, it's a different situation there. There's something different, but for the most part, and so I do think there's probably something to that too, is that for the most part, Westerns, and this sounds terrible, but aren't made for women, as I'm air quoting, like because of the historically that way. But like one of the best ridiculous, just dumb, fun Westerns from the 90s was Bad Girls.
Goes. Yeah, I knew where you were going with that.
I loved that movie so much. It was like, but it knew exactly what it was. It was totally a comment, like you said. It buys into that. It's like Western as commentary. I mean, it is the most 90s movie set in the 1890s. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Yeah, it's like almost Tank Girl. Like it's, you know what I mean? It's like knows what it is. So, you know, there's, so, you know, and I, so I obviously will revisit that, but I agree with you there. And I do think they took pains. I do think the actors knew what they were doing. They were given obviously a lot of, they hired really good actors too, because they all have shit to do. You know, there's nobody's, no, even Wu, you know, who they try to make one dimensional into isn't.
Yeah. No.
You know, everybody has layers. And so I think it's fascinating. So we'll do our brief little summary of what it is and then we'll roll. We ready?
Effort. Yeah.
We have agreed to, people, for the record, normally on this show, we do favorite and best, least favorite and worst, and then 2023 lens. There aren't any worst. We're going to skip that category.
Yes. Yeah, it's pointless. I mean, we discussed it off air and we've discussed it through messages before. Like, it's a tight 12 episodes. I think this, you know, this is a typical season one. It is kind of finding its feet. Not everything is perfect, but there's not a single standout, like, consistently bad episode. So what's the point in forcing?
There's no beer bad, so why bother?
No, absolutely, yeah.
Right? Beer, that, just, if you don't know what that is, listen back to our Buffy episodes. And if you're a Buffy aficionado, you're like, you were already saying it. So you're saying there's no beer bad. That is correct.
Or is it Brown Bunny from Fringe? I think it was called.
There's no Brown Bunny. Yeah. Betty.
Brown Betty. Thank you.
Brown Betty. Ugh. That had the potential to be good. That's what was disappointing, you know. Anyway, so the plot of this is Timothy Oliphant, everybody's favorite Hawaiian-born white guy, is Seth Bullock, who is a U.S. Marshal from Montana, and he's Canadian. Now he's a U.S. Marshal. He's fought in the Civil War. They're moving out. He wants to give up marshaling, so he and his best friend, Saul Starr, played by the world's greatest character actor. I mean, and I know it is a show full of character actors, but fucking John Hawks. I love him.
Absolutely.
And so his friend, John Hawks, played Saul Starr. They're going to move out to Deadwood, which is out in South Dakota, which is a real place. And it was unincorporated. It was on Native American land. And so it was out of treaty, whatever. And that's the plan. He's going to give up marshaling. He's going to set up. And then his wife and son, as that becomes unveiled, we'll talk about that, are going to move with him. Meanwhile, out in Deadwood, Al Swearengen, played by that limey bastard Ian McShane, runs the Gem Saloon. And we learn that it's only been like around 6 months.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Deadwood's kind of brand new and everybody's on their way out there because there ain't no laws and there ain't no this. And he's tired of marshalling and he's tired of doing all this. And we get out there and Ian McShane is kind of the town heavy.
100%. Yeah. He's the guy that's running the town. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And he runs the bar called the Gem and he only drinks coffee and whiskey.
Yeah. How is anyone alive?
How is anyone alive? They're all their livers are on the outside of their body. And we meet this amazing cast of characters. And so season one is, like you said, they're just finding its feet. Of course, later, everybody's other favorite character actor with the greatest mustache, Powers Booth, shows up and brings in different cast of characters. William Sanderson's E.B. William Sanderson is playing William Sanderson perfectly.
He is perfect, but I fucking hate Farnham.
He's the worst. But William Sanderson is like the role he was born to play, right?
He's amazing, but Farnham is so terrible.
Oh, he's the worst. And so, but he's great that he always plays that guy. He plays that guy so well. So anyway, so then in the first four episodes, the true story of Wild Bill, who meets his, and spoiler alert for history, Wild Bill Hickok, Calamity Jane, and Charlie Utter, who's the least famous of those three people, but the most responsible of those three people, come out to Deadwood as well. Hickok is trying to escape some gambling debts and some drunkenness and his wife, possibly, and wackiness ensues. And then eventually we get other Cy shows up and played by Powers Booth. And then there's stuff. So that's the season. Okay. So where to begin? What is your, so we're going to do favorite and best, right?
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. Because mine are different.
Oh, they are. Okay. Yeah, I would say mine probably are too. So there's only, as you mentioned, there's only 12 episodes per season, which is pretty impressive to get away with trying to, you know, do that shit. I'm pulling up the names of them.
I mean, they're 50 minutes to an hour long, aren't they? So they are on the longer side.
Yeah.
I mean, just whilst you're putting up names, there's just a couple of things I think are worth talking about from, you know, that HBO static sound.
Yeah.
The second I hear that, I mean, along with Deadwood, The Wire is another like perennial top five favorite for me. And The Wire is kind of the cop show version of Deadwood, I suppose. Where, like, let's reinvent what you can do with a cop show.
I've never watched. I've never seen.
Okay. I'm going to talk about one thing later.
Please. Not, I mean, I know who's in it and I know it. And it's one of those things I probably should watch. I just haven't. Yeah.
Let's put it on the list, Tony.
Yes, absolutely.
The opening credits score, the music, is wonderful. It's one of those ones that I never skip. And it just goes round and round in my head for the rest of the day, or have, you know, the next day, or depending on when I'm watching the show. I love it. But it also, another reason I think why I love it, is there's a little moment right at the end of it, just as the Deadwood title comes up, that sounds like the Firefly.
It does. It totally is. Yeah, yeah.
Then it puts me back on that world, which makes me really happy too. Yeah. So there's just like, just the first kind of 90 seconds of every Deadwood episode, just it makes me feel so happy. Then we enter the shit world of Deadwood. And you go for a whole gamut of emotions. But that first like 90 seconds, 2 minutes is just pure joy.
That is a great shout. That is an excellent opening score. And it's fun. The score matters and people forget how much it matters. HBO, again, has a show that's out, a historical fiction show. It's history, but it's called Gentleman Jack.
Okay.
It's spectacular. It's about a woman who dresses like a man, but she doesn't. And they call her Jack and whatever. And she's a real person. She's real. Mm-hmm. And she married a woman and did all, like, in the day in England. And she did all this stuff. And she's amazing. That fucking score. Mm-hmm. It's so good, and it tells you exactly how to feel in every moment, and it pushes, and you forget about scoring a TV show is different mm-hmm. than scoring a movie. You got a lot more to do, but yes. No, I definitely think the score set this show without the score would be weird.
It would. It makes me think of Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Sorry.
Okay.
If you've seen it with Jason
Segel. I have. Yeah, yeah.
Ominous tones. This is not that. This is excellent.
No, that's right. He was scoring TV and it was bad. That was really funny. But he was also making fun of.
Yeah, he knows that world.
Yeah, yeah. He definitely does. Well, for sure. Yeah, no, I think that's a great shout. It is. The opening credits do tell you everything. They have a little story. I mean, it should have. Yeah. I don't know if it won an award. You know, you can win awards for opening credits. It should have.
It's like definitely, the seven of TV titles. Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely is spectacular. Tells you everything it needs to know. Yeah, there's lots of horses running. There's a lot
some
of
nudity.
Casual nudity as you're getting into a tin bucket.
Yeah.
Because that's how you bathe yourself. I feel like the actors had to also smell bad.
Yeah. Well,
it's had to be a pretty stinky show.
There's something to be said. I think other than the first episode, the pilot, which has a couple of moments now watching it, where you kind of think like, oh, that looks a little bit like a stage. It looks a little bit mm-hmm. like a, other than the pilot, which, you know, maybe was filmed before. I don't know how this was commissioned, whether it was an immediate 12 or they did the pilot and then made the rest. I'm not sure. But the rest of it is so lived in, as you said, including the characters, like grimy, like their hair looks greasy. A little bit too much white teeth probably for a lot of them. But other than that,
100%. 100%. Well, it's funny though, because I sent you Dead for a Dollar and I asked you what you thought about Walter Hill, who wrote Alien and, you know, but did yeah. a lot of Westerns. This is the only one he directs. Mm-hmm. So it would be my guess is that was it. Because I know that I've heard Jon Favreau say he does that. He just shows up and shoots pilots for people
right.
to help them get like a show he believes in. And he'll yeah. come in and like be executive producer of a show by directing the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And then people are like, you fuck, this is looks great. And they're like, yeah, because fucking Jon Favreau shot it, but that's it directed it. Cool. So they got Walter Hill to come in and shoot. That's the only one he did, was the opening yeah. one. So that is also part of it too. They probably had a bigger budget. They had somebody who was a movie director shooting it and lighting it like a movie. The rest of it is not lit like a movie.
Yeah, true. Good
you shot. Know, so I wonder if that's part of it too. And they could have filmed it in, I mean, built this place. So it's not like they could have really filmed it in too many different places.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's cool. And the set moves, and the set is like the town of Deadwood is a character.
Yeah. I mean, Milch is very clear on that. As much as he liked his cast of characters, really, the whole show was about the main character for Milch was Deadwood itself. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it is. And it, I mean, and you've got these amazing actors. So it's not like you're going to kill too many of them off, but because they're also historical people. I mean, like, fortunately, when Carradine signed on to be Wild Bill, he's like, wait.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be in this very long. And they're like, nope, no, you're not. We had to wait for Powers Booth to get free. So
yeah,
it's like we can only afford one of you at a time. So you're going to come in. We can only afford that gorgeous mullet. anyway, okay. So what is your favorite? You go first. What is your favorite?
My favorite, speaking of Wu, is episode 10, Mr. Wu.
Same.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Yeah. All right. So this will shave off some time. I mean, there's lots of reasons why, but chiefly, I mean, the scene between Swearengen and Wu is some of the best written, acted, staged TV you could ever hope to see. And it's basically two blokes in a room saying cocksucker to each other
over and over.
It's funny, but also you understand everything that's being said between these two people. It's so well done. And this is the reference to The Wire. There's an episode in The Wire, I think it's episode maybe, where you've got McNulty and Bunk, who are kind of your two main police detectives, and they're in a crime scene. And for about the first 3 minutes, and then it gets The Wire credits, it's them just going, fuck, fuck, fuck. So I don't know, again, time scales, whether this is a little bit of a play. That. Oh. So that scene is absolutely wonderful, and I'm sure you felt the same.
And he's in Crank. He's your guy from, you just discussed him, Mr. Wu. He's in. I'm just looking to see what else he was in. I was like, I know I've seen him in a million things. He's got only 268 credits.
Oh, Christ. Okay. Yeah.
He does a lot of voice work, it looks like.
Yeah. He's that guy that can turn up and do your job.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever you need. Yeah.
So that scene is wonderful, and I think makes this episode stand out anyway. But this is the episode really where it's like, okay, this is Deadwood from now on. Mm. This is what it's going to be. The stall is set really for the last three episodes, so 10, 11, and 12. It's almost like a mini movie in a way. And I think this is the show that knows what it wants to be. And this is how we're going to move forwards. We're going to have outside forces constantly putting pressure upon those people now who have sort of formed their little units. By this point, even Al and Bullock have a kind of working relationship, just about. It's hard for anybody to have a working relationship with Bullock.
I know.
He is the best friend Bullock could ever hope for. My God, he just knows everything that guy needs. There's an episode coming up as well when he, you know, get away from me, Saul, get away from me. And Saul was like, yeah, this is the moment I'm stepping back.
Yeah, yeah. He says, well, there's the one time where he's all pissy and he's going to ride off to get the one after while Bill dies. And they're just bickering like a married couple. And he's like, you want me to pack your bag? And he's like, yeah, that would be great. Nice.
Yeah. So I think, that's why episode 10, there's lots of little moments that stand out, but I think it's like, oh, we found ourselves, here's where we go. And from this point, it's pretty near flawless, I think.
Yeah, I think what I love about it, all of that, everything you just said, but what I love too is that it shows, this is the moment when, well, there's two things that happen. Is you learn more about Swearengen in this than you knew. Like, he's shown ripples of humanity, and I would argue episode 12, which we'll be talking about in a second.
Oh, okay.
Spoiler. when we see that, and he says something that is, again, just a brilliant piece of writing. But it's in this moment with his conversations with Mr. Wu. When Mr. Wu walks in, he walks in the front fucking door. And everybody's like, all these hillbillies who don't even know how to read. Mm-hmm. Like, don't know how to, like, illiterate dumb fucks. But they're white. And so they think they're better than Mr. Wu, who's a fucking businessman genius.
So he runs the Chinatown section.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, he also knew what he is, the Swearengen, because the history of the way the Chinese got there was they built the railroads, right? They were like indentured servants or paid really poorly. And without the Chinese, America isn't connected. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but what would happen is people like Mr. Wu would come into these little towns as soon as they were set up. Because all these Chinese people would be around. He would know how to broker things. He didn't build the fucking railroad. Look at him. He didn't lay any track. He is in, but he knows everything. He knows he's genius. This is the episode where you know for sure he's faking that he doesn't speak English.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Without a doubt, he speaks English. Whether he, I mean, and I know he, cocksucker. one cocksucker, not two. It's a character. So to me, we learn about Mr. Wu here a lot, but we also learn a lot about Swearengen in the way that they're like, do you want him to walk around the back? He says, just fucking let him come up. And then And then, they, you know, when he does the respect thing when they go there, and he does make him leave the back, but he even gives him like a pat on the back, like, you got to give me this. And so then what he does later in the episode is he gives that back to him by being, every time I come here, you want to do that. And there's like, and he, and fucking Allison's like, well, he's, I'm not going to say what he says, but he says, do you think any of these people can understand what you're saying? And he's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They see how I'm reacting. And so then he's like, oh, good meat, good meat. And then he's doing a bad job. But the idea of like, oh, I get it. He's the, like, he finally understand too, that he is the Swearengen. Like they need each other for the town to work too. And Swearengen knew that.
Swearengen gets his dope from him, doesn't he? Yeah.
And he gets, well, he gets everything from him. He gets his meat from him. He does his laundry.
Yeah.
I mean, he's, you know, he does everything.
He eats his,
he eats his dead bodies.
Pigs eat his dead bodies that are made nearly every episode. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I loved it. I think it was just such a smart, it was just a smart way to go about him saying, these are people. They matter.
And that part was going to become more important and be seen more as the show goes on as well. So yeah, it's a definite opening up of the town.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true. So I just thought it was such a brilliantly done, well acted, really smartly written. Like you said, it sets it up, but it also just gives you that thing, and it shows a little bit of humanity in Swearengen and the way that he treats Wu. Agreed. Yeah, and it's not that you want him to be—he's not a hero. I'm not suddenly pretending that I think he is awesome, but he's definitely—he's always. What's the right hand guy's name? Eddie?
Dan Dorothy.
Dan. Right. Sorry, Dan. He's always trying to show Dan how to be a person. And in this, because Dan can read. Dan has a heart.
Yeah.
Dan gets easily duped later by a special guest star, young Kristen Bell, who is amazing. Yeah, earlier. Right. But he always learns, and he's, and I get why Dan's his Watson. You know, I get why he's there. But he teaches him, and he, you could get why he picks him, why he trusts him, why they trust each other. You know, it's just, it's, it's just such a great relationship builder. And I love Mr. Wu as a character anyway. And I just think he's so well played. Keon Young is so brilliant in that role. And, you know, it's a tough role to do. It's tough. He's got to really act Zasap. It's like, as we've been talking about our friend from Discovery, Doug Jones, fucking acting your ass off, right? Inside a fucking costume. And he's got to act his ass off while pretending he doesn't know what anybody's saying, like, or faking that, whatever it is. It's so good. So I could watch this one. If you wanted to get people to I think you could watch this one as your, if you dumped into Mr. Wu, you would understand everything that's happening. Because like you said, if you, now the one after it and the one before it, not so much. Cause those are part of a bigger, because this is a launching something.
Yeah.
Like you said better than I did, and in fewer words.
Oh, you're right, because we get the Yankton and we get Young Adams comes in this episode, doesn't he, as well? And he's going to become an important character. Speaking of Dan being Swearengen's right hand man, Adams is going to be an important figure in his group later on too. And you get this is the episode, right, where Al, obviously what Al is doing, he's resolving the dope problem,
right?
Because their courier's been assaulted, killed. I think, in fact, hasn't he?
A Chinese courier's been killed.
The dope's been taken. Now, is it in this episode when Al? It's all resolved, isn't it?
Yeah,
Al finds out Leon, and it's, is it? I can't think of the guy's name. Is it Jimmy? Maybe
that he drowns, and the Leon's the guy who lives. Yeah,
yeah, and all
he
of
works
that
for Psy.
So Leon works for Psy and Jimmy works for Al. But we get these little moments where, like, he drowns Jimmy by doing a short straw and he lets Leon live. And then Dan's like, well, why? It's not Dan. Somebody else says to him, like, why would you kill your own man? And it's Dan.
Dan. It's the guy. It's the media, the in between from the government types. Al?
So it's Adams.
Adams. Yeah. Adams who says that. Yeah. Because he's getting Adams into his confidences here.
So why would you kill your own guy? And he's like, well, it's the long game, isn't it? He's playing because now he's going to go back to Psy and he hasn't killed Psy's guy, which would cause a problem between them. And now the next chess move is from Psy to decide what he thinks he wants to do. because as a white guy, as you said, he shouldn't be killing another white guy for a Chinese guy. But Al is always that master chess player, that like Machiavellian villain, isn't he? He's the Iago. He's 10 steps ahead already.
He knows.
And we see that.
Yeah. In this episode, you see it completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you also see, like, you know, and he, some episodes he shows his humanity and some he doesn't. And this is one where, you know, he kills a guy, but he does it for Wu.
Yeah.
And you're right. He does it
and himself.
And of course it does start, you know, essentially, you know, they're trying to start a race riot by, you know,
yeah.
Which again, okay, do your own fucking laundry.
Yes. Yeah.
There's an amazing film. It was called A Day Without a Mexican. Guess what it's about? In it, there's a rapture type thing where all of the Mexican Americans and or actual Mexicans who were born in Mexico but who work in America were all raptured for a day, and it takes place in like Southern California. How do you think that goes?
Not a lot gets done.
It's fucking brilliant. It is one of the funniest works of satire. That's a tough title, but it's that, like, I feel like as I'm watching this and I'm seeing the way that they treat Mr. Wu and all the people and the way that, you know, they're like terrible racist, awful race, like calling each other cocksuckers and motherfuckers and whatever. It's fine. Mm. Whatever. It's almost like a term of endearment, like, you cocksucker. But it's like, but the way that they, you know, the way the things they say about the natives and the things that they say about the Chinese people are really horribly racist, awful, awful. And I don't believe that Al is that. I think Al just says it because that's what people need to hear. I don't think he gives a shit.
Yeah.
I think he's a live and let live guy. Like, he respects, he respects Wu. He respects the Native Americans who are there. He understands who they are. They're badass. They'll fucking kill us all. He's not dumb. You know, but so I don't think he's racist. I think he says that's that Machiavellian thing that he said. And I think you see that on display here. You're not sure what kind of person he is until this episode. So that's what makes it my favorite.
Yeah,
because
the other thing, sorry, just finding out the other thing is his dealing with the reverend.
Yeah, which we'll talk about too. Yeah, it's good here, but it comes back around. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's got a tumor, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And in this episode, he's in the bar. Somebody's playing this fucking new piano that's what our
that he asked for so Dan got
but I love it, the reference in there, like kind of tapping his foot and singing along, isn't he? And like, he's just his deterioration is really hard to watch,
and the actor's so good.
Oh yeah, because he's such a nice genuine guy at the start of the season, and how he performs his deterioration is cruel upon him and really hard to watch. But the way that Al deals with him is very sympathetic as well.
Yeah.
He's quite rude to him in front of everyone, but he does the same thing with him as he does with Wu.
Mm-hmm.
It's quiet. He's like, you know, if you want to come back here at any other time when nobody's around, it's fine. We'll do whatever we need to help you. So again, Al absolutely has a sense of humanity, and he has a set of principles which you and I wouldn't abide by.
No.
Because he fucking just drowns a guy without even thinking twice about it. But he does have a set of principles where certain things do matter to him, and he won't cross that line, or he will look out for that person. And we see that again through the reverend.
We do. And this goes back to our noir love, right? We talked about it with Sleeper. There is a code. And there's a code here. Everybody's got a code. Seth has a code. Saul has a different code. Saul's just one big heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He's the best. But same with Doc.
Yep.
You know,
Jane, Trixie, they've all got,
they've all got their own codes. They've all got their own, and it could be survival. Like, and there's genuinely decent people. Like, Ellsworth's a genuinely decent guy, but he also knows how to shut his fucking mouth.
Yeah, and or when to say the right thing.
Correct, but he's still
saying he's going to shut his mouth. Yeah,
right. He's genuinely good. He's not like He doesn't want to hurt Mrs. Garrett, Alma. He doesn't want to hurt her.
No.
You know what I mean? He doesn't. He's looking out for himself too. And he knows he can make a shit ton of money by doing what he's doing, but he's just a dude. He's the dude who's like, it's representative of a lot of the rest of the dudes in town, you know, who are like just working. They weren't sold, bought and sold. They're just like trying, man, this seems like a place to try. I'll try here. And that's what Charlie is too, obviously, but Charlie's in a different position than he is. So we've got these characters who are just like, this is the world that I live in. How can I survive in it? I'm not optimistic about everything. I'm just realistic. Mm-hmm. Where Saul, for some reason, is optimistic.
Yes. Yeah, he is. Absolutely. Yeah, it's true.
It is true. And I don't fully, I mean, it's just, I don't understand why, but I'm glad. You know, it's like this place sucks, man.
Well, Seth needs him. That's why.
Oh, yeah. That's true. That is totally true. Yeah.
If Seth was left to his own devices, if Bullet was left to his own devices, it'd be over very quickly.
A long time. He would have been dead in Montana. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Somebody would have definitely killed him.
Yes. Because he saw there to be like, hey, maybe you should calm down. Maybe you should take a walk.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Well, so are we still saying our favorite then is episode 12, Sold Under Sin? Or the best, well,
that,
I mean?
Was our favorite.
Best? Yeah.
Sold Under Sin, I think, is the best episode, which I know we've spoken before about season finales, and it's a little bit of a...
We can cheat, but it's okay.
Yeah, it's a wonderful episode.
So it ends the season. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting place to cliffhang. If it never got picked up, it was a good end. So I think that was smart of them to make an ending where it's like, this is the end of this story. Mm-hmm. We can pick it up. We don't have to. So the best line in the whole thing for me is when he kills the reverend and he says, rest now, brother. Now, you could argue that is about, you know, because he's a reverend, he's a brother, whatever, but it's about his brother who had epilepsy, who didn't have a brain tumor, but who had fit. He's like, my brother had fits. That's what he says. And that means, obviously, back in Chicago, his brother in Chicago had epilepsy. That, you know, that's what they called it then. And obviously something went wrong for him, and maybe he had a tumor, whatever, but his life wasn't good. His life was hard because of his ailment. And of course, so I don't know if that is implying that Al killed his brother too, or this is the mercy he couldn't give to his brother, whatever. But to me, that is the best line in the episode, maybe in the whole season. And, and of course it ends with what everybody wants, Oliphant being a marshal.
Yes. Well, sheriff.
Sheriff, right? He's a sheriff again. Despite
resisting it for nearly 12 hours, and I didn't realize this until doing some research for this. This is only supposed to be set over about three weeks.
This whole first season, really?
Yeah, it's about 3 weeks of actual history in Deadwood, which is crazy.
Was it busy 3 weeks? I'm glad I wasn't there.
Yeah, he managed to resist for 3 weeks, putting on the tin again.
Yeah,
it's a great episode, this, and it's another one of those with some really good moments, really powerful moments. I think that Al moment's great, and I love the fact at the same time as doing this mercy killing, which is what it is, Doc knows that's going to happen when he gives him to Al, and he accepts, because he's had a wonderful scene before when he's praying to God, a God he doesn't believe in, to help take the Reverend, and why is God so cruel, and why is this happening? Such a powerfully acted scene, that. Because for a moment, you get really jolted out, don't you? Because he goes into like a performance within a performance. He loses himself in his memories of being at the Civil War and seeing what happens to men there. And yeah, it's wonderful. But when Al is doing the mercy killing of the Reverend, he's also using it as an opportunity to teach Johnny how to smother people to death properly.
Correct.
Which, again, another layer to Al. And I love the character of Johnny. I think he's so fun and charming. So if it, again, it's kind of
such a doofus.
A doofus, but this is a layer of corruption, right? This is corrupting that doofus sense that we've had of Johnny up until this point. And now, oh shit, now Johnny's going down that path because that's where Al's taking him. And
but that's the only way Johnny can survive. He's not smart like Saul. He can't read, he can't do anything. He's got a good heart, but he can't, there's no place for him.
Yes. No, there isn't, other than being somebody's lackey.
Right.
Like a willing, and we get the culmination of Bullock and Alma, don't we, as well?
We do.
A long time, and everyone knew it was coming. That's watching the show and is living in the show, they also all knew it was coming.
Yeah, I mean, but shocking.
It is hot as fuck when those two start getting it on. The chemistry is palpable.
Yeah,
you tell me those two people didn't fancy each other in real life, you are lying.
You are lying. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the chemistry, and it's, you know, it's Clooney Lopez levels of
that's
like,
I knew you were going to say that. I knew that's where you're going.
This is off the screen. Like, I can tell you two do not mind doing this scene.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and it was because I'm sure the actors feel that way. And they're both excellent actors. They're both very, as Derek Zoolander would say, they're very, very good looking people. But the writing got us there. It wasn't, they didn't, it wasn't, because it isn't a will they or won't they. That was fucking, it's not that. It's not a romantic comedy. We knew they would. Everybody knew they would. Everybody knew as soon as they saw each other the first time that everybody knew.
Yep.
So it's about when. And they did it. It was perfect. And this is what makes it the best episode, is because you set everything up. This is how you write a 12 episode arc. If you knew you had 12, you gave us 12. It wasn't one of those where you're like, I need to write Beer Bad because I need a filler episode. It's like, I have 12 hours of TV. And that's why some of them are 50 minutes and some of them are 48 minutes or whatever. It's like, this is the story I need to tell. The episode preceding it, Jewel's boot is made for walking, culminates here. But Jewel, whom we meet and we see again, Al's humanity early on, even though he calls her a cripple and all this stuff. And he's mean to her. And like when she's pouring coffee, he's always like, let me do it, blah, blah, blah. And so it makes it seem at first like he's saying that because he's like, doesn't want her to spill, but he doesn't want to embarrass her.
Well, yeah. I mean, he doesn't need to keep her around.
Right.
He kills people and gets rid of people for a lot less than what he says he puts up with the Jewel.
Yeah.
He chooses to keep her there. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but because of his brother.
Yeah.
And so we see that difference there between the two of them too. And Jewel, the woman who plays Jewel, is magnificent.
Yeah.
And she is delight, and she glows. And when she says cocksucker, is really funny. And the episode previous, amazing acting. So the end of this with her dancing with Doc.
Yeah, it's a wonderful moment.
It is so, it is after all of this, there's just been a mercy killing and there's just this and there was a pseudo hate bang, whatever that was. And, you know, and we know that Saul's put himself in a bad position because he loves Trixie and rightfully so. You know, I mean, like everything is happening and it's all culminating and it was drips and drabs and amazing writing the whole time. And so we finally get to this end. This was why it's not cheating in this particular instance to say this is the best ending. This is the best episode, is because you gave us everything there. That's why because there aren't any bad episodes. You had something to pull from and you managed in an hour to bring all the stories together.
Mm. And this is where the Trixie Al from episode one pays off, isn't it?
100%.
It must be around, is it episode 10 as well? I'm not sure. It's a couple of episodes before, maybe episode 9. Yeah, as you said, Trixie and Sol sleep together
in the hardware store. Yeah, yeah.
It's a hilarious scene as well when he walks in and it's so obvious what's going on.
I know.
Oh, I just need this. And he just grabs the vest.
Grabbed a clamp. And then he carries it around the rest of the time. He never just, like, he doesn't just drop it. Because that's, you know, Saul would beat his ass if he, you know, if he dropped, you know, a tool, something they could sell.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So brilliant. And then, so the whole time, the rest of the episode, he's carrying that stupid clamp around.
But as we come to learn, Al's genuinely start to develop some feelings for Trixie, hasn't he? So her having sex with Saul out of choice rather than payment is a problem for him. And he's been a bit of a sulky teen for a while.
Oh my God. Sulky teen is well said. He has been.
But then they get a nice little knowing look at the end. And as you said, all these things come together wonderfully. And it shows Trixie goes from a place where he's got his boot on her neck and he could snap her neck or suffocate her. And she has no choice. She's been sold to be there. She is now choosing to be there. She knows she's got some sway. She's got some power over Al. She's given him that gold that Alma gave her. But it's not about that, really, because he says, I'm not going to get any more of that. She's like, no. But what you will get is more of me.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants that. So she's finding her place, and she knows that she's got some sway and some power there. And he is willing to concede that he needs her in that way. And I think that's where the payoff for what happens in episode one, again, which is what makes this such a good moment.
Agreed. I could not agree with more with any of that. And I think, I mean, I love Trixie. I think she's such a well-written, and again, and we'll get to that, we'll hold that. But I think the performance is amazing. I think what they do with Trixie is amazing. I think that I get it. I get what Saul sees. He's like, she's this woman. She's so compassionate. She cares about everybody.
Mm.
She is smart. She knows how to read. She has again, the teeth are probably way too good, but she's lovely. She's like, she's lovely to look at. And I think
Sophia takes her immediately. Her and Alma get on really well. She walks all these different worlds. She's paid to have sex with people, with gross, disgusting men.
Yeah.
She puts up with that. But then she goes and walks in Alma's world and fits in perfectly there. And when she's all dressed up and...
For the funeral.
Alma, I'm assuming Alma gives her one of her dresses and stuff. Yeah. Looks like she fits there as well.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's like she's just like sort of angelic. You know what I mean? It's not like... When you say she's lovely to look at, that she's pretty, which she is. It's not that. It's that she's just... There's something like... You know, there's those people where you're just like, you know, who's like this in the world when she's in things, like she's hard to look away from Bryce Dallas Howard. There's this thing about her that whatever she's doing, whether she's in Shyamalan in the early movies or whatever she's in the
now
Help.
Now she's a director in the
Now she's a director. Universe. Yeah. But when she's like in the Help playing the villain, even, you know, and then the Help. Hard not to look at what Jessica Chastain is doing in that movie, her doppelganger in that movie together, because she's spectacular. And Octavia won the Oscar, rightfully so, for that. All of that. She's all these amazing actors around her. When she's on screen, there's just something. She's, it's that, I can't, what is going on there? And that this woman who plays Trixie and the way that she portrays her, whether it's she's an actor or it's just her as a presence, there's just, she has one of those things where you're like, what's going on? And I think, and I feel that way about Hawks too. So I feel like, is there, and that's why it's such a good character, because whatever he's on screen, whatever he's in, he's so great, and he's a scene stealer. Max Perlich, our friend from Angel, when he shows up, like, he's that same way. He's one of those character actors, like, whatever he shows up in, like in the movie Beautiful Girls, he's in there for like 8 seconds, but every scene he's in, you can't look away from it. There's like something about his presence, and I feel that, and it could be just that's why she was cast in the role, or if they're like, they realize that, and they're like, oh, let's lean into this. I don't know, but she's amazing, and just everybody shines, and that the dance, I just loved it. It was like, how at the end of a show that had at least 150,000 cocksuckers said and cold-blooded murders and children, you know, infanticide, you're like, oh
yeah,
my heart is full
and I can't wait to find out what is going to ensue when somebody who is righteous, as Bullock is, within his own set of wobbly principles, but he is righteous, is now going to start laying down the law around town. And Al knows as well, there's a lovely moment between them of like, he says in an earlier episode, doesn't he? Like, if anybody could be sheriff, it should be you. I think it's in the previous episode.
Yeah.
And then have a little moment of like, when he says, I'll put it on. I'll be the sheriff. Have you got it on you? Yeah, it's in my pocket. And we're all like, of course it's in his fucking pocket.
Yeah.
And they have that little moment between the day. These two, again, like talking to people who are great on screen together.
Oh. And it's is it him, because like he and Coggins in Justified, which we'll talk about, the greatest on-screen bromance ever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's electric. And so I don't know how much of it is, it's just because Oliphant's charming and he's such a good actor. They just know how to cast him with the right people.
It's interesting because, Oliphant is much better in Justified than he is in Deadwood. Now, that's not to say he's not in Deadwood, but there's a definite growth in him as an actor.
Sure.
By the time he gets to Justified.
Well, he's hanging out with Ian McShane. I mean, he's hanging out with all of the greatest character actors.
So,
learning to be a leading man.
Yeah, there's an innate chemistry, I think, to him, obviously, because he's been in stuff before. It's like Go, he was a really big presence in that movie.
Was that his first movie, too?
He was had really good presence in Scream 2 as well. So, it may be, I'm not sure. But I think, I think time in McShane's company, time in Hawks' company, helps him to grow. I think he grows across this season, actually, as an actor, too.
Yeah, and Powers Booth. They're not on screen much together, but he's there. You know, talk about a guy who commands a room every time he walks in, you know, and he knows Powers Booth knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
You know, and everybody is. I mean, like I said, the guy who plays the hotel owner, he's the worst, but he knows what he's doing.
William Sampson, yeah.
William Sampson, he's so good, yeah. Well, that is clearly the best.
Yes,
episode. Now, there are no bad episodes, but I would say my least favorite episode, and I think it's mostly, when we talk through 2023 lens, we'll talk about Jane a little bit and the way she's handled. I don't really care for Plague. That is my least favorite episode. Six.
Okay.
The Plague episode. Jane becomes the nurse because she's immune, we learn.
Yes. Because she's come into contact with Andy out in the woods when she's
It would make sense that Jane would either be immune or have already been inoculated. because she was on the tour with Bill and Charlie. Charlie's no dummy. Charlie's clearly inoculated. I mean, Charlie's fine. They don't talk about Charlie being immune because he's like an educated man who probably made Jane and everybody in his care because he ran the Wild Will, the Wild Bill show. He probably made them all get shots. I don't know. I just felt like, and it was nice to see the Reverend do something, whatever. And this is part of when we start to see his seizures come through. But it's just like, fine. Again, there's not a bad episode, but it's like at least like it felt that it didn't move to me. And again, the next one is even called Bullock Returns to Camp, just as a friendly reminder. This is the one where I don't know. It just feels like you miss him. And I know you're building the other characters up. I just say
no, it's interesting. Yeah. No. You're sort of convincing me it's not quite as it's not my least favorite.
It's fine.
For reasons we'll get into when I talk about mine.
Yeah.
But you convinced me of that. I don't think they really wanted to write about the plague. But this is historical Western, so they had to.
They had to.
So it was like, well, fuck it, we'll do it in one episode and we'll get it done with. I do think the Jane and Doc relationship is wonderful.
Sure.
They're the two most antagonistic, difficult to like people in camp, which is saying a lot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, Al can turn on charm. Bullock is an asshole a lot of the time, but if he wants to be, he can be charming. Of course he can. It's Timothy Oliphant. Doc and Jane have no level. They just say what the fuck they want to anybody.
At 11 at all times.
But what is wonderful is that everyone comes to understand that and comes to love them in their own way.
Right.
But when you get the two of them on screen together, again, another pairing which really works. I think those scenes when they're together are wonderful. So I think perhaps I agree with you on all those counts. It misses Bullock. This is the threat level his presence in camp presents, because it does, because everyone's either scared he's going to shoot them or start an argument or react badly. But I think Jane and Doc, for me, kind of just pull this back from being my least.
That's totally fair. And I think that's true. And I think I'll save it for a minute about what they do. Mm-hmm. I do love the performance, what she does with Jane.
Mm-hmm.
The actor's very good, and she knows what she's doing, and she knows the task. And this one, we see her sober. And so again, that's an acting feat to have to watch her go from drunk to sober and back again. And again, how does she function? How does she, you know, and her heart is good when she yells at people like, go fucking rest, to the minister. And, you know,
yeah, another person that really cares. She really cares about a lot of people and a lot of things. It's just, it's hard to see it sometimes.
Right. And we understand why, you know, I don't know. I was just like you said, it felt too, for a show that's supposed to be historically accurate, the plague sure burned through pretty quickly.
Yeah. Agreed.
Do you know what I mean? Like okay. And it would have made more sense. And I know they're like, we don't want this, but it would have made more sense if the plague, and it sort of does start in the previous episode, but like if it started in episode 5 and it didn't, and I know they don't take the plague tent down for a little while because that works with Joni later, blah, blah, blah. But like, I think it would have worked as the B plot in 6 episodes, as opposed to the plot of 1 episode. And I was just like, that was all. So that's there's a lot to, and again, it's not bad. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying this is my least favorite.
I think it's totally fair.
I would never skip it. There's not, it's not one of those. So anyway, so what's yours?
Now I can't decide. Mine is either the next episode, episode 7,
Bullock Returns to Camp. Okay.
Yeah. Or episode 8, the following one.
Suffer the Little Children. Okay. Because that's the one with Kristen.
As much as I love Kristen Bell and Veronica Mars and The Good Place and other things that she's done, and as a person, these two and this subplot is very weak. She arrives to camp, doesn't she, with her brother?
Mm-hmm.
If it's her brother, pretending that they're looking for their dad. And they separate, and the brother starts working at the gym, and she starts working at Sy's saloon, which I can't think, the name's escaping me now. What's his saloon called?
I'll think of it while you're, or I'll look, using the internet doctor to tell me.
The Bella Union.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
She starts working there. And I just think this subplot doesn't, what you were saying about the plague, it's almost like, you know, we don't want to do it here. I think it's a subplot which perhaps they decided wasn't really working, or they didn't want to spend any more time on. And it just, every time we go to that, I don't really care. The other stuff in camp, I'm interested in. And yeah, whenever it's those two on screen, which is, I don't want to say about Kristen Bell, but whenever it's them, and actually probably more her, like the Dan stuff with her is gross. And I know it's meant to be, but it's gross. The Joni stuff with her is weird and doesn't really work. And I know she's playing both those people. And then obviously the ultimate like killing of her and her brother by Sai, which I know again is it's purposeful for the show and for what they're trying to show of the character Sai, that actually you'd much rather be dealing with Al than you would be with Sai. I get it. It just feels brutal for the sake of brutal. I don't know. Just something about that plotline doesn't work for me.
I hear all of that, and I agree. I do think that it's, again, a testament to Kristen Bell's spectacular acting ability to flip. There's just, I mean, it's just like this is a masterclass of all actors. Everybody shows up and fucking lands. Like, I'm on Deadwood for half a minute. You are not, there's no walk-on parts here, right? You gotta, even everybody's acting their fucking asses off. And this is, she's great. And it's an excellent performance by her. I get why they cast her for this role because of what she looks like, because of her size, because Kristen Bell still is a tiny person. Yeah. And she, you know what I mean? So like with that one that she did, that satire she did about the woman in the street and the house from across the road, whatever that thing that she did, that series, she's genius in that. But even that, like she's so tiny and they play into that, you know, the stuff they make her do, her physical comedy. So I get why you cast her, because she can play a little girl, even though she's clearly a woman in her 20s. We know she's a woman in her 20s. She could pass for 16. So I get it. I get all of that. Everything you said is true about the why this was supposed to show us that Sai's worse than Al. That's the point of that story. And you need it in some way. He can't be mean. He can't do the things he does to the two people who are closest to him. He's already thrown Andy out of camp, right? He's already said, Andy, go out and die. I don't give a shit about you. So you're like, okay. But you're also like, well, Andy fucking had the plague.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, I mean, you could have killed him. You could have mercy killed him. You know, and again, so there's that juxtaposition between like, just go leave him out there to die as opposed to do what Swearinger does. So it's always about that juxtaposition. So I hear everything that you're saying. I almost think it would work better is if Kristen's character stayed good. She wasn't a double crosser. That she was this pure of heart good person, and he kills her anyway, and because it was like a very Jean Valjean, she stole from him and then he put her down like he did, it would work better. But because she's also playing it, like you said, in that gross way, because at first her thing with Dan, I mean, I know Dan's into her, but you also could have written it like he's trying to like be a big brother to her. Like, don't you know what I mean? So I think, and I get it, it's what it is. I'm not trying to rewrite it, but I think that might have fixed your issue. But I get why. I mean, I was torn between the two of those. And I definitely think like the Bullock return to the camp is just, it's literally a middle up. It's a bridge.
It's a reset almost, isn't it? It's like,
it is. It even says that in the title.
Part of season two. Second half of season one. Yeah.
Correct. It's just telling us what's happening. So I understand why that one is there, because we needed to breathe. We needed to get everything done. We had to kill Wild Bill. We have to get Bullock back. We have to do all that stuff. We have to know, we have to show how smart Charlie is during that, all of that stuff, right? All of that made sense to me. And we need to get Charlie back to camp because you see how bad Jane is without Charlie.
Yeah.
So for me, Bullock returns to camp was, that's why I get what you're saying though. But so if I were with you, like Suffer the Little Children would have been like just below plague for me. I hear what you're saying, but that's my, so I tried to fix it. I didn't fix it. I only pointed out your point that yes, those were problems.
Yeah, it's a shame. And it's, you know, it's interesting. It's what, 6, 7, and 8, isn't it? It's that midpoint of the season. It's and again, they're not bad episodes. There's a reason why we don't have a worst.
Yeah.
But there's just little nitpicks about these ones where things aren't quite right. But again, considering it's season 1 of a show, they're still finding their way. As you said, they knew hard 4 episodes. It's all about this. Get to camp. This happens. Hickok dies.
So gotta now do that.
Gotta do that. So now it's that little soft reset for where they want it to go.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think so for me, you know, that is just, yeah. And so I'm okay. I'm okay. It's still excellent TV.
Yeah. I, same as you said. I'm going to repeat your words back at you. I would never choose to skip these episodes. I would still watch them.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't tell you now how many times I've watched Deadwood all the way through. It's a lot. I didn't skip them. I know what happened. I still watched them.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Enjoyed them.
And you still enjoy them. And because the performances are still great. Kristen Bell is excellent.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the thing. It would in worse hands, that doesn't work as well. And again, I get what you're saying. It just doesn't work. I don't mind that they're evil and they're conniving or whatever. And I mean, this will be a good transition to the 2023 lens, I think. The language, not the cocksucker and motherfucker and all of that. But the language, the racist, sexist, homophobic slurs. We see it from Sai. We see it from she calls Joni a dyke. She's like, I'll take care of the dyke.
Yeah.
Obviously, they say all the racial slurs that you can imagine are that they if you can imagine a racial slur about all nationalities and all races. So it's races, creeds, religion, which I have a point we'll get to. There's a thing in episode 2 that Saul says that almost broke me in half. All of that is there. So like through the 2023 lens, I mean, that's where I would love to start before we get to the dongs and the boobs. I would love to talk about the racism. What are your thoughts? How do you feel hearing all the words and having these actors who you know aren't those things say those words?
I think we discussed this before recording through messages. I think because of what it is, I just accept it at its face value. Now, we've discussed a lot about, like, you put those words in the mouth of the villain or of the antagonist of the characters you don't like because they're racist. So that's another layer on top of why we don't like them. Here I know there's probably a broader spectrum of people that are using that kind of language. But considering where it is and when it is and what their life is like, and they've chosen to go to a lawless town, everybody is there by choice, right? Because they don't want to abide by the wider...
Well, the prostitutes are not.
Fine, okay, sorry. Majority of people...
The men are there by choice.
Yeah. Sure. Okay, so the majority of men are there by choice. So I'm not excusing it, but I think it's there because it's there. It's prevalent.
It wouldn't... The show wouldn't work without it.
No, it would feel like they've written around it and we'd all notice the... I think I would notice that more than I noticed the slurs, if I'm honest. Because it feels like that is happening. So I know I'm watching with that in mind. Whereas if I felt like they were choosing to avoid it, that choice would stand out more.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's tough because, you mean, all the actors... And again, like Keon Young and all of the... you know, Chinese American actors that they hired, or, you know, Chinese actors to be in this, they had to know this is what's going to happen every day on set. Yeah. Fox had to know this is what we're going to say to you.
Yeah.
Sorry, man. And you know, going in. And so there's that. And then like the guy who plays Eddie, who's, you know, the Al thinks he's gay. And whether he is or not, that's pretty horrific, the stuff that he says. And then like Jane, because Jane is androgynous, and that's, you know, who Calamity Jane is, whether she's asexual or gay or whatever she's, you know, so like between she and Barnum, they fight all the time because he doesn't want her in the hotel. You know, and it's not that he doesn't want women in the hotel. He doesn't want her in the hotel because he doesn't know Barnum. Wrong circus barker. You know, that he doesn't want her there because she makes people uncomfortable because she's a woman in a suit.
Who fights
like a man, and, you know, and she's like, oh, you got to have balls, you know, and she's something. She says some great lines. So anyway, I think that's fair. I agree. I mean, it's just always tough. Like, and this is part of my issue, as we'll lose our audience here, with Tarantino, is I don't agree with his use of it in the way that he uses it, uses his racial slurs, not in Django. Right?
Sure.
Okay, fine. Inglourious Bastards, you get away with it there. Hateful Eight, you know, it's like he's figured out how to do it, like how to use all of his, but I'm sorry, like his character in Pulp Fiction is unwatchable. And I know he's played for laughs, and I know the argument is his wife is black. you know, and you see that in the cutaway scene and the of her coming home.
Yeah.
I just can't. It's just really, because, you know, Travolta doesn't say it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, it's intentional. It's mm-hmm. it's a choice that you've written that in your character because it's you. And his whole argument is, I can say it because I'm from Compton. Well, I don't care. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're around your friends and you're saying it because those are your friends and they're fine with that. So it's like, because it isn't a time and a place, but that is the excuse that he uses.
Sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because his heroes are still supposed to say it. Or in this, like, everybody's awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know who doesn't say, you know who doesn't use racially disparaging terms? Trixie.
Sure. Saul.
Saul.
Seth, I don't think does either, actually.
No, right. Doc doesn't.
Alma. Doc. Right.
So it is interesting, the use of the slurs does give you a sense of who people are. So, you know what I mean? So, like, I'm okay, because it goes back to what you were saying. Like, you give the bad guys the bad words, but you're like, but wait, is Seth or Swearinger in the heroes? No.
Yeah.
They're the antagonists. They're not the hero. Yeah, yeah. Or the protagonists. They're not the hero.
Yeah.
Right? Trixie's the hero.
Like, on paper, Seth should be, but he absolutely is not.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Charlie is the hero. Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you
yeah.
can see who the heroic figures are. Joni, like, we see who they are, and they don't say those things. So I do think it's a choice.
You mean the guy that beats Alma's dad near to death in front of everyone is not the hero of the story?
He's
what?
Not the hero. and the fact that he had to then go to the other people and say, you should take him.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because he needs to be under the army's care or I will fucking kill him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not a great guy.
No, he owns it at least.
But then when he beats the Native American in that fight.
Yeah, amazing.
He felt that.
Yeah, he did. And my favorite moment, we're off topic now, but sorry, now we're on him. My favorite moment with Bullock is when he loses his temper talking to Al when Saul is sleeping with Trixie.
Yeah.
Like, your prostitute is over there with...
Yeah.
He says,
I'm only talking to you because my friend's fucking that whore. That's what
he says.
Right. It's like, oh, brutal. What a line. And he doesn't feel that way about Trixie.
No, not at all. But he's because he's just, he can't, he's red mist, isn't he? When that red mist is, it's gone, absolutely. But then he realizes what damage he's done to Saul, because Saul has to end up paying $5, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he doesn't make it out to be Al's fault. He owns it. He's like, no, that. Actually, I'm sorry, Saul, that's my fault. I told him when I was there, I was angry, I shouldn't have said it. That's what I do like about Bullock, is that he owns his mistakes, his temper. He knows that's who he is. He can't change it.
Right.
But that's not heroic, but it is a positive side to a difficult part of his character.
Well, this will go to my point. In episode two, he's so mad because he's like dirty, because Al says dirty Jew to him.
To Saul, yeah.
Yeah, and so they're standing there at the store, and Saul's like, he's like, what he said to you? And Saul looks at him and says, I've been called worse by better people.
Yeah.
And that just hangs there. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
What did you say, Seth? Because he's saying that to Seth, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
100%.
Do you think it's about what
people said? I think it's about them. I've
read it that way. Interesting.
Oh, that's what I felt. I was like, oh my God, he's saying, when we first met, you probably said,
interesting.
Get out of here, Christ killer, or some other bullshitty thing. You know, whatever he said, whatever people say about Jewish people that are stupid. Whatever dumb racist thing people say about Jewish people, I felt. So you didn't read it that way. I read it that
this watching
that Saul was looking at Seth, and there's a pause when he says it, and they look at each other, and I'm like, fuck. That's what I felt. And that Saul is the hero because he is forgiven. They're still best friends.
Oh, I know what I'll be doing when we finish this chat. I'll go back and watch that scene.
Please. It's in episode two. I was like, so anyway, so okay, well, I'll be interested to hear what you have to say. So anyway, all right, let's talk about, you know who's totally qualified to talk about the ladies of Deadwood? Two straight white guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like nobody better.
No. I mean, we could use the bullshit excuse that bad politicians use and say, we have wives, you know, we have partners, we have women in our life. Yeah, that's such bullshit. It doesn't mean that you're not a prick because you have a daughter. So stop that nonsense. So, anywho, let's talk about it.
Well, I just think, I said at the top, I think there's pains taken to write these women as in an impossible situation. And ultimately, by the end of the season, maybe not at the start, but by the end of the season, finding their way to navigate through this world. And it's highlighted in episode 11. Alma has a commentary looking out of her bedroom window, which she's done right back at the start of the season again, when she was hooked on laudanum and she was watching the camp. She just stayed in that room constantly. She's watching the camp. And actually, you could argue, calculating and working out her own little plans for things for later on.
Yeah.
Maybe not purposefully, but absolutely that's what it comes
to. We wish fulfillment. She's wishing. Yeah.
And it's when her dad's arrived in camp and she's looking at... And she's talking about, like, you know, there are the men resolving the world's problems. We've finished dinner. So, of course, if we were back in high society, we'd retire to the kitchen to talk about frivolous things like dresses and they'd have cigars and solve all the world's problems. And I know that's quite a stereotypical statement she's saying, but it's definitely true. We know and we've seen it in lots of media. Her awareness of that. She's talking to Sophia, I think, isn't she, who can do nothing with this right now.
She doesn't speak English still.
But she wants her to be able to do something about this when she is older. And that's why it's a powerful moment. And that's why it's really important. And I think that's why when she is with Trixie, they align. She takes great pains to be polite and kind to Jane. Alma does as well. So I think whenever the female characters are put together in a non... I mean, I'd still like the moment in Endgame when all the MCU female characters get together. I think it's a real just...
I love it, yeah.
Because it knows what it... Again, it knows what it is. It's like, fuck off. We could do this if we want.
Right, and we did. So here it
is. I understand logically it doesn't really make sense, but as a moment for what it's supposed to do is brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think this show does that too. When it gets the women together, I think it takes great pains to show what women are doing and what they have to do in order to make their world keep turning. And because Joni's the fourth character, I think, that does this too, isn't she?
Because she's gay and a prostitute.
Yes.
And maybe owned by, like, clearly bought by Sai at one point.
Yeah, because she says that, doesn't she? Yeah. He bought her off her dad, who was sexually...
But we also assume Alma's dad was sexually abusing her.
Yes, unfortunately we do, from his intimate way he's touching her,
Yeah. And so that's, again, this is what I'm saying, though. This is what this show does differently. So through the modern lens, it's 2004. So this is this show doing something that in 1968 they weren't doing. And I think and right now they don't do. They don't always, they're not willing to not have a flashback, to not make the actors act those scenes. They're discussed. It's there. It's happened off screen. Like you said, with Kristen Bell and that kid, that's not really her brother. So there's a weird sexual tension between them, but they're not really siblings. It's a scam. So we get it. Like, so it's gross. It's like that weird thing that's happening. But like those, for those two women, Joni and Alma, have gone through a very similar horrible things. We know Trixie's goes through all of the prostitutes too. By the way, in the credits, some of them are just like whore number six. That's their name. So that's a little problematic too, writers. Give them, you know, I mean, I know you're playing in your own thing, but... So yes, so what they did to show the restraint is say this happened to women in this time. And this is why Sophia is such an important character, because everybody descends on protecting her, and not just the women mostly, but Ellsworth, Bullock, Charlie in particular. Charlie is just wants to, I feel like he saw Joni and was like, oh, you remind me of my sister. You remind me of somebody that I need to save. And I love the way he cares so much about her, and she treats him with respect and he treats her with respect. Yeah. And they're not used to that because they're second fiddles in their own, in their own world. Like they know, like I'm the brains of this fucking operation in both of their, so they are really kindred spirits there. And I love that friendship and the intimacy that they share immediately. And, but they all take to Sophia. So she is clearly literally a bright white blonde shining example of innocence. Yeah. They couldn't have picked a more, and this is the only thing this actor, right, has ever done.
And yeah, like, it's not subtext, is it? Tony?
No, not at all. No, text. If she had just put angel wings on and instead of calling her Sophia, they called her Angel. Angela, we would be, you know, like, okay, thanks for at least not doing that, because Angela wouldn't have been a name that the people she comes from would have used. Anyway, so we could, Sophia would. But yeah, I love what you said. I think it's totally true about all of that. I you know, we talked about the language, we talked about that. The Calamity Jane stuff. So this is my one problem through the modern lens is, and I know a lot of this is based in fact, but I still think they, at the beginning, and we know we see her grow and change and everything, and she's clearly suffering post-traumatic stress. Mm. She's got her own abuse from her own life. Charlie and Bill love her, who she is. She's not in love with them. Like, I know it comes off as like she's in love with Bill, but she's like, it's like a blood debt, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah,
she saved her life. I don't like, and it's just, it's, she does a great job, but I don't like how dumb they make her seem sometimes. And so to me, and again, that's not a modern lens. I guess it's just more of a complaint because it is what it is. It's the choice they made. So they're not, the rest of the women aren't dumb. The women are the smartest people in the camp. So we're not pretending that they're saying women are dumb. Jules got her own shit going on, and you see how smart she is and how far ahead of the game she is. So it's not that. I don't know. That's just the one problem I have with, like, again, you're using a historical person here. I would have liked that to have been a different character. I don't know. It's just my one little, comes through it. And the episode you talked about, the plague, my least favorite episode, but she does, you see her humanity and the way that she takes to Sophia too. I owe you a penny. And then, and then Charlie shows up to pay. That's my favorite part. It's like, here's your money that she owes, that Jane owes you. And that's so brilliant that, like, that's how good of a person she is. So she's not dumb, but she plays it dumb early. And I just don't. And like when she sees Andy at the river, there's just some parts of it that rub me the wrong way.
No, I hear what you're saying. I think if I extrapolate what you're saying, I think you see her as a character who is played for laughs.
Yes.
I think that's a fair criticism. But I guess to send my riposte, I think.
Please.
To use a Deadwood term, to riposte. I think they rip Farden for saying it at one point, don't they?
Because he doesn't know what he's saying.
Absolutely.
He's one of those guys. He's those guys in Sin City, the big, who've read the thesaurus, and they just talk like they know what they're saying.
I think it's just a counterpoint later, isn't it? I think it's a bit like the Trixie owl. Mm. I think it's a counterpoint. She's the town drunk. She's got, you know, there's a scene where she's asleep leaning
against the wall,
which is hilarious. I hear you. I can see that being a problem. I can see why, knowing you, I can see it.
Yeah.
But I think it's just so when we do have this transition later, we get to see what's really going underneath with her.
But it was the alcohol making her that way. That's not who she was. And I'm sure that's true. It's just, rewatching it again, I was like,
criticism.
No,
she leaves the show, obviously, doesn't she? Around episode 9 or 10,
yeah. 10. And I'm assuming that's just the historical accuracy of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? She's not around. We're not keeping her there. And I know it's, but she doesn't stay. So you can't be like, oh, and Calamity Jane was there. Well, she wasn't. So you got to write her off.
Yeah, but I hear that. I think it's totally fair. Just to do that devil's advocate, just to repose.
No, I love it. No, I love to hear it. And I think that makes a lot of sense too. But we talked about racism and sexism and homophobia through the modern lens. And interestingly enough, a show that takes place in, you know, the middle of nowhere handles all those things straight on. It doesn't pretend. Doesn't pretend they don't happen. And I don't think, and this is always my concern, it's my concern with The Boys, it's my concern when your sister and I went through Assassination Nation. My concern is always that the people are going to get the wrong opinion. So that is through the modern lens. We, as people who've read a book and who think thoughts and who watch art and think about things and live in the world and are respectful of, aren't racist, sexist, homophobes, we can watch a show that has racist, sexist, homophobes in it and be like, oh, they're bad. Because we, as we've said, Doc says this and Saul says this and Trixie says this and Jane says this. And, you know, because even Jane's heart is so big. She saves Andy.
Mm-hmm.
First, she tries to give him whiskey. Which I love that. I mean, I love that scene. And I know, again, that's played for last, but that's also...
You know, probably prefer water, cocksucker.
Yeah, right, yeah. So she, that's when you start to see her change, you know? So it's like when you get to that episode 4 or 5, she becomes this person. Then she leaves, which is, you know, disappointing. But all of that to say, there's this... you get into the, you see who's good and you see who's bad. So therefore, this horrible language, this horrible racism, this horrible, 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 we can, that's why Heathers is my favorite movie. Terrible things happen in Heathers. But it's because you, it's pretty clear lines. Mm-hmm. You know, the hero of Heathers is Martha. You know, like, it's her movie. Mm-hmm. And she is us. We're Martha Dunstock. And everybody else is terrible. Everybody's terrible, right? The end. Even Betty Finn says some pretty terrible stuff at that. You know, it's like, so it's very clear distinctions. And I do think what works for me from the modern lens is that we have Saul and we have Trixie and we have, you know, and we have Joanie, we see a clear delineation of how to be good. So therefore it makes it work. Whereas other shows, but my concern is, do people see this and are like, Al Swearengen's awesome. I want to be like Al. I want to be like Cy.
Now, maybe Al. I can't. Yeah, I don't. I hear you. I think the difference. Now, I've not watched The Boys yet. I've read all the comics. I've not watched The Boys. I think maybe once it's all done, I will. And but I've obviously seen and heard the stuff about Homelander.
But you know, you've read the comics. It's the same issues with the comics, too. You're like, Billy Butcher's not good.
No.
Yeah, I don't love that people. I mean, you can love him, and Carl's amazing. Mm-hmm. Talk about bad language. But he's not a hero and he knows it. Like Carl's playing it like he knows it too.
Yeah.
And the guy who plays Homelander knows it. And they both get mad when people want him beat. They're like, no. Mm. You know, so that's my anyway. Sorry, I didn't mean
also,
to jump
No, you're right. But where the boys hang on. I was gonna say something, but perhaps if people are only watching the show and haven't read the comics, the boys will resolve that at some point.
Yeah, right. Yes. We don't know what they'll do in the comics and the show.
The comics stops it, doesn't it? I don't think those sort of people are watching Deadwood.
Okay.
I think The Boys is accessible because it's superheroes and it's on trend for what's going on right now. I mean, I don't know how well watched this was. I think enough. Obviously, it got 3 seasons, but then it was cancelled.
Yeah.
Because it cost too much and not enough people were watching it. But it's also very complex. It's dense. It's languages. Tough to follow. I don't think those type of people that you are thinking of mm-hmm. would choose to watch Deadwood. Or if they did, I don't think they'd get very far through it because I think they'd be lost.
That's fair. Okay, that's good. That makes me feel. And again, that's just always a concern. And again, you know,
I hear like, you though. I hear what you say. Yeah. Al's the one, isn't he? Al is the one because McShane is so charismatic.
God, he's amazing.
You can't help but like him. But in that same way that I teach every year when I teach Othello, you can't help but admire Iago. He is the worst fucking human being.
In the world. In all of Shakespeare. I think
everybody's agreed.
Like, oh, Shylock. I'm like, no.
Yeah, no. Always
you
Iago.
Have not read that whole play. If you think Shylock's the villain of that story, you've missed the point. But Iago is a monster. But
there's always a but with Iago because it's so clever. It's so... Yeah. Have to admire what he's doing, the levels he'll go to. And I think that's the same with Al. You have to admire the way that he does things, but you don't admire him.
But I agree. And same with Bullock.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all facts. All right. Well, so here we are at the end of our first season. What did we miss? What's our lightning round in our final 10 minutes to go here?
I think the only thing to bring up is like how well stacked not just the main cast is, but even just like cameoing players or people turning up. You know, to back out Kristen Bell, I made a little list of people who just seem to turn up for a minute or two. You get Nick Offerman, you get a lot of Nick Offerman, you get all of Nick Offerman, Billy Song. You get Joel McKinnon Miller and Dirk Blocker, who are both from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. They pop up in this. You get Glenn Morshower, who's a great character, who's in like Friday Night Lights and 24. You've got Marshall Bell. You've got Peter Coyote. You've got all these like big actors, actually, or go on to have like successful careers in shows. You just pop by every now and then in this show. So yeah, it was nice watching it this time and like keeping a mental note of all the people who were in it, which I thought was fun.
No, and they're all, again, nobody's, that is testament to what we were saying. These people aren't showing up for this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they know it's some, and it's like, it's when you start to get, and again, this was season one, but again, because you had Walter Hill at the beginning, because you had, you know, Ian McShane, like you saw that, you tell the top five and you're like, oh, John Hawkes is in that. I bet you that's good. When's he bad? You know what I mean? Like, he's one of those people that you and I like, that people like who love movies love John Hawkes. He's never the lead, but he's always good. And, you know, he, like you said, he definitely made Oliphant a better actor, I'm sure. And I'm sure anybody who works with John Hawkes, like, fucking dude, is a pro.
Yeah, right.
You know? He's amazing. And so there's certain, like, DJ Qualls is one of those actors who's got a lot of Hawkes in him. He's like, you know what I mean? Like, he shows up in something and he's just got that presence, and he knows he's not the leading man. I mean, John Hawkes knows what he looks like, and DJ Qualls knows what he looks like. And they want a movie where they play brothers, because I would buy the shit out of that. But, like, and I want that, but it won't get made because they can't be top billing. Like they need Mary Steenburgen to play their mom or something. So it's like, you can have a top person. They're like, we're not giving, nobody wants the John Hawkes, DJ Qualls movie. I want, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Like,
he's
one of those. So I'm sure that people see who's in it and they're like, fuck, I'll be in that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I want to show up for that. So I think there's a testament to that too. And then plus it gets around like, oh, I read that script, or, oh, I didn't get the lead. I tried out to be Ellsworth. I tried out to be Trixie, but I didn't get it, so I'll show up and be this character who's got six lines, or I'll show up and be, what do you need me to do, because I just want to be on your show. So that there's something to that too, about good writing. And, you know, they're younger, like this is younger often than younger Kristen Bell too. So but there is a testament to, like, good, I always say too, casting directors should win awards, because you get that, you know it's it's a lot on them, and so they have to know what they're doing. And this is a well kept, like, Brad Dourif is so great. I can't imagine anyone else having. And again, because he plays Chucky, because he's a good voice actor, because he's a good character actor, because he can do all kinds of things, what he's willing to do, his emotional swings. Like, he goes from, like, screaming it out to be like, okay, Jewel, listen. Like, in 3 seconds. And that's a voice actor thing, right? Because you have to be big and small all in one thing. So, yeah, it is. It's an amazing show. I'm glad we're doing this.
Yeah, I think the only other thing that suddenly, as you're talking, because, you know, for a show that is so ist at times and is dramatic and has lots of death, I think it's worth noting, it's also really funny.
It is really funny. It is.
It writes lines of comedy dialogue. It has comedy physical performances. So I think that's worth noting as well. Like, it hits on all levels. And I think at one day, you know, we should probably do a straight comedy show. We seem to live in the kind of drama at the moment with Season's Greetings. But this makes me laugh a lot. Often.
Me too.
Times, because of the line is so well crafted, or almost like a stand-up. Like, it drops a breadcrumb here, and then by the end of the episode, it does something over here. There's this moment when Doc says to the newspaper press guy,
Merrick,
he's coming to see him, saying he's feeling ill, mate. Is it the plague? And he's like, no, it's hard on your back if you're getting fat. But that's been laid in from early in the episode with, like, plague, and we're seeing Merrick eating a lot, and with Merrick
all he does
diet.
Is complain about the food that he's constantly eating.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, it's almost like a really good stand-up when they drop that breadcrumb, and you're like, when you get the actual joke at the end, you're like, ah, okay, I get it.
No, it is really funny. I agree. Yeah. It's funny. And I think, you know, just like the scene where Trixie and Saul are going at it, and Saul and Seth comes in, he's like, oh.
Yeah, yes.
You know,
yeah.
Like, that's really good. And you know, Oliphant's funny.
Yeah. And Al with Farnham is nearly almost always funny.
And again, that is because
fucking repeat back to me what I just said is
William
an amazing
Sanderson
scene.
Is oh, I know, that's so good. But again, Sanderson is so brilliant. It's like,
oh,
he is the joke. He is the clown. Yes, like, if this is Shakespeare, to go back, if he's Iago, he's the clown. Like, he's one of the many, you know, all of Shakespeare always knew to have comic relief, and it is clearly Farnham, and he doesn't know. And that is, he is playing it as farce.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah. it is a commentary and satire. And like, again, Sanderson's got the chops as an actor to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it could, and again, I think that's what my problem is in those early episodes with Jane, is it's not playing it, it's farce as farce. And okay, whereas, yeah. where I think like Farnham is a joke and Sanderson is playing it satirically. Mm-hmm, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Yeah. And Charlie is really funny.
Yeah.
Because the thing that I like about Charlie is Charlie just says, and like you said, Doc says, Doc mm-hmm. is like the, you know, as we talked about on Buffy, right? You needed to make sure that you have the characters to say the inside stuff on the outside, right?
Yes.
That's Cordy's job. And then, you know, they write her off and she does it on Angel. And then
Spike does it on Buffy.
Right.
Yeah.
Spike does it. And, you know, you need somebody to say the inside stuff. Anya definitely, you know, says it all the time. But you need somebody to say the inside stuff outside because that's funny. And especially when you play it straight like that. Like, Doc isn't playing it for laughs. And Anya wasn't playing it for laughs. And Spike wasn't playing it for laughs. But if you don't have that, and Cordy on first three seasons of Angel wasn't playing it for laughs. It was just like, I don't know how else to be. So, you know, that's why it works. Yeah. Now, this is, dude. Obviously, we'll be playing the theme song that you mentioned on the intro and outro.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
I mean, because we don't hate ourselves.
No. And if we can get the soundbite, Al saying, who cut the cheese, just to put right at the end, that would be great too.
Of all of the swearing and everything
it's
that
a funny
says,
show.
say, who cut the cheese, when everything else is vile. It's so funny. All right. Friend. In a month's time, people will be back to listen to us talk about the next season of Deadwood.
Yes.
And then in 2 weeks' time, we'll be talking about another season two of Sleeper.
Of course we will, yes.
Two weeks for Sleeper, 2 weeks for Deadwood, 2 weeks for, then we'll be on Criminal.
We will, yes.
Wow. We had a lot of blood and guts.
Yeah, we're living
lots
in
of
it.
Nipples and people saying fuck.
Yeah. Creative language all the way.
Yes. Oh man, so brilliant. Well, thank you for this. So this will come out on, so people can find out what we'll be filmographying. This will come out on the 24th of August.
Okay, so at that point you would have just had Crank High Voltage
with Mr. Wu.
With Paul coming back to discuss Crank 2, another potentially problematic piece of media, which we do our very best to talk around. And Paul didn't want to say some of the lines, so I saved them and I said them for him. Prepare to be offended, people.
Please. And that movie is epic, though. So, yeah, it knows what it is.
It is. And then just after that, I've got 13 coming out with Math. So that's your next... couple of episodes from me before I start getting to kind of that next stage of Stath, Expendables, Mechanic, that kind of, we're hitting that era of Stath coming up pretty soon.
Nice. Well, that's amazing. And just to tie it all together for everybody, when we do volume two of, or season two of Sleeper, yes. There's an Expendables line in there.
There is an Expendables line in there.
Like, yeah. Do you, it's an issue one. Have you started reading?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's amazing. So it all comes together. Well, so I will have that. By the time you hear this, last week will have been me talking about The Beauty with Allison and Cody. And then we have this. And then next week will be possibly the beginning of our show with the Crash Course Comics with Heath and Paul and I. And we're doing a two-issue 1986 hand-drawn thing by Arf Comics out of Dayton, Ohio, called Death Craze Teenage Superheroes. I own the copies. I've made copies for people. It was technically published in Bowling Green, Kentucky, but the guy, Jim Erskine, is from Ohio, and it's this crazy, stupid comic book that only Heath and I read. So we're going to make Paul read it and see if it's any good.
Bro.
It'll be amazing. No one's going to listen to that one, but Jim Erskine might be like, people, yeah, you'll listen. Thank you. I appreciate that. So that's what we've got coming up. So friend, and then follow that will be more Sleeper. So that's it. Every 2 weeks, you and me back on every Thursday, every other Thursday on Comics Motion. It's the Brewbreaker and Phillips of Comics Motion, and we're here to stay.
It's the Seth and Saul.
That's right. I've been called worse by better people.
Oh, man, you are definitely the Saul. Don't worry about it. I, I, I have the temper of Bullock at times. There's no doubt.
That's amazing. Well, friend, this is great. So let's hear that lovely theme song. And who cut the cheese? We'll see everybody next time. Bye.
Take care.
And I want to know who cut the cheese.